This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. The Conservative Party conference starts this Sunday in Birmingham, and it will be the first time that Theresa May has addressed the membership at large as a leader. But in the background, there are rumblings of division. Are the Cameroons preparing a rebellion on grammar schools? Are any cabinet positions currently vulnerable? And how long can Theresa May's honeymoon period really last? Isabel Hardman is now joined in Liverpool by Fraser Nelson and Matthew Paris, and from London by James Forsyth.
So James, we've obviously had the summer recess and then just 2 weeks of Parliament being back before the conference recess. But what have we learned about Theresa May so far?
Well, I think the intriguing thing about Theresa May is this is a politician who's been on the Tory front bench for 17 years. But everyone from cabinet ministers to civil servants is still trying to work out, you know, what she is going to do as prime minister. Now, I think in the Tory party, there's always been a sense that especially Tory commentators are yearning for a leader like Margaret Thatcher, who famously chucked Hayek's Constitution of Liberty down on the table and said, this is what we believe. Theresa May isn't like that. But I think it was very telling that Damian Green, you know, who's known her since they were at university together, when he was asked what drove Theresa May, what she was about, said it was a kind of innate sense of public service. And I think that is the kind of Tory she is. I think she is cautious and pragmatic.
Fraser, do you agree? We've seen her making quite a bold reshuffle at the start of her premiership.
We've had plenty of boldness from Theresa May, not just the reshuffle, but her decision to unilaterally tear up a 3-decades-long consensus on grammar schools and selective education. I mean, there's been no end of boldness. It's almost as if she won an election, which she kind of hasn't. And at the moment, it's very difficult to tell anything about somebody from so short into their rule and their reign. And we've only got 3 or 4 things that she's done that we can analyse. And it would be a great mistake to extrapolate a few weeks over the course of a few years. But what does seem evident to me is 2 things. One, that she isn't interested in David Cameron's One Nation conservatism. She's explicitly said, I'm not so concerned about the poorest, I'm concerned about those who are a few rungs up from the bottom, the ones that get overlooked. I think she saw in David Cameron's agenda the kind of the rich man in his castle and the poor man at his gate kind of analysis. And I think she's changed that for earthier kind of conservatism. And on schools, she doesn't see any reason why not to go back to the Tories' default position, which is part, of course, her biography. She's a grammar school student, and it seems as if she wants to make her life story, in a strange way, part of her governing philosophy. Now, I'm not a great fan of that. I was a great admirer of David Cameron's school reforms. In fact, I think the last 6 years are pretty good ones for Britain. I'm not hugely keen for a change in direction, because I thought the previous direction was all right. But who knows what's in store? I certainly don't.
Matthew, do you think that these differences that she's striking with David Cameron are wise?
No, and they rather surprise me. We're saying here that we don't really know very much about her yet, but I have learned one thing. She's a bit of a shin kicker. I'd never thought of her as a shin kicker. She's kicked Nicky Morgan, former education secretary, in the shins. She's kicked David Cameron in the shins, and in ways that will only infuriate them. And I don't know why she's done it. What's the good of poking people with a stick? They've gone. It's best to be nice about them and say they did a great job and then get on with the job you're doing yourself.
She surely is wanting to say, this is my own government, I'm going to do it in a different way. She's distinguishing in a way that everybody who's ever succeeded a prime minister has distinguished.
I don't think everyone who's ever succeeded a prime minister does distinguish. Jim Callaghan didn't spend his time saying what was wrong with Harold Wilson. John Major didn't spend his time saying what had been wrong with Margaret Thatcher until she started saying what was wrong with him. No, you should be generous. It's better to be generous. If she has a distinctive Mayism form of government, if her ideas are clear-cut, and if what she's going to do has any kind of a profile, that will emerge. It isn't necessary to give the impression that she thinks everything Cameron did was a mistake. He was, after all, elected.
And James, do you think that the cabinet largely sort of agree with the approach that May's taking, or are we already starting to see disagreements amongst ministers?
I think one of the fascinating things about this cabinet is how independent-minded it is. Now, partly Theresa May deserves some credit for this, because when David Cameron had cabinet meetings, there was always someone who came in after he'd spoken in coalition, it was Nick Clegg. In government, it was George Osborne, who essentially indicated what the meeting was going to decide. And for that reason, you know, you didn't have very many full and frank discussions in cabinet. With Theresa May, it's all a bit different. She's letting people speak more, and given Philip Hammond's frankness, I think there is a new tone of kind of candour to cabinet discussion. But I think there's also something else going on, which is there are an awful lot of unsackable people in Theresa May's government. I personally think that the free Brexiteers are unsackable. Downing Street can slap them down as many times as it wants, but it can't shut them up. And I think Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, is also unsackable, because in the current period of economic uncertainty, if Hammond were to walk away saying, I can't make this work, you know, it would have an absolutely devastating impact on the government. Now, I don't think this means that any of those four are currently thinking in that way, but I think it does show the limits to May's authority, and the limits that will kind of continue until she has her own electoral mandate, which I don't think she will try and seek until 2020.
Fraser, do you agree that we're not heading for an early election, even if that means that May can't really get through many big radical reforms?
Yes, I do, for the simple reason I think the Conservatives would be crazy to have a general election before Britain has left the European Union. Because if they do, then the referendum will be replayed through a general election, and that will give Labour far much more support than it would otherwise have. So yes, Theresa May is going to have some tight votes in the House of Commons, not least the vote on her grammar school proposal. But she has got 4 years in power, 4 years in which it doesn't seem like the Labour Party are going to get much better very quickly. So I don't think that Labour need to be on election watch, as we're hearing so often.
It is also worth cynically noting that nearly all Tories accept that the party couldn't have two unelected leaders without a general election. So weirdly enough, waiting for a general election until 2020 also kind of solidifies Theresa May's position in a way.
Matthew, what do you think Theresa needs to do next week at conference in order to solidify her position with the wider parliamentary Conservative Party and also with the membership?
I think it's very difficult for her next week. She can't say anything more about Brexit because I don't think she knows herself what's going to happen. The grammar schools thing has not gone, I think, as she would have planned. It's become a divisive rather than a uniting policy proposal. On the other hand, I think she'll be an attractive figure on the podium. Conservative conferences are always disposed to like a new leader. They'll carry her to some extent aloft on the wings of their hopes. But what she's actually going to be able to say, search me.
I think a lot of Tory members, in fact, a lot of even non-Tories, will be just pleased that she's there in the first place. It had looked as if after the Brexit vote, we were going to have a resigned Prime Minister and then weeks of, perhaps months of Tory civil war. Instead, we had what we really needed at that point, which was a leader with a clear agenda and clear direction. So no matter what she, you know, if you might agree or disagree with what she's done so far, the fact she's able to provide stable government at a period where it looked for a while as if things could go rapidly the other way, I think is something that a lot of people will still feel grateful for. The Tories will be grateful they've come through this and have not torn themselves in two, which was a real possibility during the campaign.
And we're in Liverpool at the moment and watching the Labour Party tearing itself in two. But James, do you expect the mood at the Conservative conference to be very serene and upbeat, or do you think it might be a little bit jittery given there are policy rows and given that the party does have to make some really big decisions on Brexit?
I think it will be fairly upbeat, because one of the natures of Theresa May becoming Prime Minister is that kind of honour is satisfied. The Brexiteers are happy that Britain has left the European Union, but the Remainers know that they have kind of one of them in charge of the process of leaving. But I think there is an interesting thing, which is you saw a bit of it last weekend with the Tim Shipman book and the Craig Oliver book. You know, you are beginning to get the kind of noises off that can slightly destabilise her. Now, the Cameroons are not a parliamentary force in terms of numbers in the way that, you know, the old right of a Tory party are. But they are capable of making a lot of noise. And I think it is interesting how willing they already are to sound off. You know, look at Nicky Morgan's willingness to come out against grammar schools, George Osborne to come out against a hard Brexit. I think we are seeing quite a lot of that. And I'll be interested to see whether she can keep a lid on all that during conference.
Fraser, do you think that that faction of angry Cameroons represents a long-term threat, or do you think they'll find other things to do and slink away once May really sort of establishes herself as someone who is able to do things and just do things differently to the last Prime Minister?
I could be wrong, but George Osborne strikes me as an unlikely new Bill Cash in the making. I can't really see the Cameroons settling down to be the kind of in one long Ted Heath-style grump for the next few years. Interesting, George Osborne is staying, of course, and he's dripping this wonderful menace now and again, saying he's going to be the torchbearer of the liberal consensus. I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but I doubt it will amount to more than a few irritating interviews.
Matthew, what do you think Theresa May's greatest threat is over the next few months?
Well, I think it probably is, if not George Osborne, at least that strand or those strands of the party for whom he speaks. And I would, if I were Theresa May, I would take the threat quite seriously. I don't think he's going to be sort of perpetually grumbling like Ted Heath. I think we're probably going to find him quite upbeat, cheerful, good-humoured, but persistently not convinced by some of the things that she's doing. Whether he is the right bus stop, so to speak, for those who become dissatisfied with her leadership to wait at, I would doubt for the moment, but he's playing a long game. I don't think the mood of the conference will be triumphalist in any way. I think it'll have some similarities with this Labour conference, which is not particularly warring. It's just people have come here to Liverpool with a sense of what's going on. What is this man like? What is he going to do? And I think there's going to be some of those question marks hanging in the air at the Tory conference in Birmingham too.
I think the funny thing about Theresa May, she doesn't particularly want to tell us who she is and what she's going to do. If she had a leadership election to run through, we would probably know by now. But now she's been spared that, she seems to be keeping quiet. That's her trademark. That is who she is. And I think the funny thing about Mayism is I don't think it's an ideology. I think it's a modus operandi. And that is to keep your cards very close to your chest, to trust two or three people kind of maximum, and to basically not offer yourself up anything like as much as a public figure as David Cameron did and Tony Blair did. So, you know, you can argue that's welcome, that prime ministers shouldn't be offering running commentaries on the state of the nation. It does make it a lot harder to guess what sort of conservatism she believes in, which makes it difficult for the likes of me anyway to work out how much do I support Theresa May. Well, it depends what she's going to do, and nobody's quite sure about that. Not, I know people in her cabinet who don't know why, still don't know why they've been appointed. I mean, that is how she's that's how secretive she is. So it's very difficult even for those sitting next to her in a cabinet table to work out what kind of conservative she is and what direction she wants the country to go in.
I think there's a fine line that she's trying to tread, which is not devaluing the value of a prime ministerial intervention by commenting on everything, but at the same time not creating a political vacuum that her opponents, both internal and external, can fill. I think that is a very, very difficult tightrope to walk, and I think it will be watching how she tries to pull that off over the next few months and years will be absolutely fascinating.
Matthew, can I ask you, what will Theresa May have to do for you to judge her first year as a success?
I think it would be impossible to make any judgment after only a year. I think she has a probably insuperable task ahead in negotiating the terms of a Brexit that will please all wings of her own party. I just don't see how it can be done. It wouldn't matter if she was the Archangel Gabriel. So I think simply to get through this year with resounding cheers from a Tory conference, which she will, and no big rebellions in Parliament, is as much of a success as she can hope for.
Matthew, we're both at the Labour Party conference. People are coming up to me, I'm sure they're saying the same to you, saying, you must be delighted. Look at the Labour Party. It's out of power for a generation. Tories must be cock-a-hoop. Are you cock-a-hoop? And if not, why not?
I'm not cock-a-hoop because the Conservative Party only exists to repel or resist the advance of the Labour Party. That's why I joined the Conservative Party. I don't know what conservatism stands for, but I knew I wasn't a socialist. And once we don't have a proper enemy anymore, we're going to fall apart as well. And I would predict that that will happen.
How quickly?
2 or 3 years.
2 or 3 years.
That was Isabel Hardman with Fraser Nelson, James Forsyth and Matthew Paris. And now, a word from our sponsors.
If you've ever wanted to start a wine cellar, 2016 is the perfect year to begin. Berry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit every taste and budget. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Last week, Russian activists turned up at the launch of a new Jock Sturgis exhibition in Moscow to protest against the inclusion of photographs of nude adolescents. Sturgis's work has been controversial the world over, but in Russia it came up against a new wave of anti-Western feeling, which has, in Owen Matthews' words, seen Russia fast becoming a very puritanical place. So, what's behind this trend? And is Russia really as coy as it now seems? I'm joined now from Moscow by Owen Matthews. So, Owen, why is the Putin era proving to be quite so puritanical?
Well, partly it's a reaction to what happened in the 1990s, where anything went, when basically every kind of tenet of decency and morality was jettisoned along with communist morality. And Russia descended into a kind of amoral, extremely traumatic for most Russians period. So I think the Russians themselves haven't changed that much. I think if you look at opinion polls over the years, they're a pretty unreconstructed bunch by European standards on anything from, you know, gay rights to foreigners to Jewish conspiracies. You'll find that Russians are pretty conservative en masse. But what's changed is that we see a very clear movement by the Kremlin to impose a kind of orthodox-based morality on society. And that's been gathering pace for a while now, but now it's really kicking into high gear.
And so is Putin actively encouraging this then?
Yeah, surely. I mean, the thing is that he, to find out what the Kremlin thinks, and you just need to watch and listen to the Kremlin-controlled media, which is their main instrument for controlling society and setting the agenda for society, the Kremlin-controlled media being all the media. And you see time and time again, and most recently, just this last weekend, there was a big outcry over an exhibition which is featuring nude photographs of, you know, adolescents, which of course has been controversial in America as well, because America, as we know, is also very religious and very conservative. But I think a very clear pattern emerges that the Kremlin is trying to create an atmosphere whereby Western liberalism, decadence, tolerance of homosexuality and so on are being cast as a kind of moral assault against which the Kremlin and Russia is standing to protect its citizens from Western decadence.
And who are the key figures pushing this puritanism? You obviously have Putin, but in the church, are there key figures also pushing it?
Yeah. Well, there's several crucial people who clearly played a big role in Putin's ideological development. One of them is a guy called Bishop Tikhon Shevkunov, who is Putin's personal confessor and is extremely conservative. He's a very high-profile broadcaster, and he believes that the church and the state have a joint moral duty to save people from moral perdition. It's a very old Russian Orthodox idea. I mean, the Russian Orthodox Church and state have never really been separate at any point in pre-revolutionary history. So we're just seeing a sort of reversion of that sort of church and state forming one kind of block for moral and legal coercion of people. And the other ideologue is a guy called Alexander Dugin, who has been sort of a very radical voice in Russian politics with his theory of Eurasianism. And that's also been knocking around for most of the century. But the basic tenet of Eurasianism is that the West is decadent and doomed, and Russia has a sort of moral duty to save the world. So those voices are becoming increasingly mainstream. And their message is that the Russian church and the Russian state should work together to create a kind of moral world.
That was Matthews joining us from Moscow. And finally, no Prime Minister since Lord Salisbury has sported a beard, but there's been something of a hirsute resurgence in Downing Street this summer. Nick Timothy, Theresa May's chief of staff, has facial hair that would be more at home in Shoreditch than Whitehall, bucking the trend of clean-shaven, ruddy-cheeked men at the nexus of power. In this week's magazine, Emily Hill writes how she is mesmerised by Timothy's beard, but that what might be catnip to a quirky artisanal barista is poison to the British electorate. Emily's with me now to debate this issue, and we're also joined by Keith Flett, founder of the Beard Liberation Front, which organises the Parliamentary Beard of the Year Awards. So, Emily, why are you so fascinated by Nick Timothy's beard?
I'm just mesmerised by it. It has a sort of hypnotic effect on me. I just look at his face and get lost in his beard, and I wonder where it comes from and what it means.
And what do you think it means?
I think it means, primarily, I am unelected, because if you think about the most iconic beards in the 20th century, you're going to think of a fascist dictator like Hitler with his neat little moustache. Also, communists, you know, Marx had a massive beard, very iconic. And Fidel Castro also has a beard. And in fact, his beard was considered one of his assets. And so apparently the CIA made this audacious bid to put thallium salts in his shoes so his beard would fall out. But they failed.
And Keith, you organise the Parliamentary Beard of the Year Award.
Yep, I do.
In Emily's piece, she says that men with beards can't really be trusted. What do you make of that?
Well, that's a kind of age-old prejudice, pognophobic kind of idea that you're hiding something behind the beard, and of course that still applies officially. The passport photo, they're often very unhappy usually about people with passport photos with beards, because they say, you know, you could shave it off, then you'll be a different kind of person. Well, you won't, but you'll look different. I think that's, you know, every stereotype has a grain of truth in it, because it wouldn't work, would it? So clearly, probably wander out here now into the park out there, and we could probably find some old bloke with the remains of his lunch in his beard. But, you know, that's pretty unusual. Most people these days that have beards, it's quite a trendy thing. They're looking after them. You can find kind of places that specialise in beard oils and beard preparations and so on. So I think that's, you know, the time has moved on a bit from that kind of idea.
And obviously Jeremy Corbyn has a beard. Yes. What should we make of that?
It says, I am completely unelectable. I am not Tony Blair. Peter Mandelson shaved off his moustache and New Labour was transformed into an election-winning machine. They did all these market research. They got in all these sort of market researchers and showed lots of voters pictures of the bearded and non-bearded male. And they overwhelmingly preferred the beardless visage. And Tony Blair's three elections were almost guaranteed from that point.
And Keith, do you think there's been a rise in popularity of beards in politics?
I think there has. I think that's quite right, incidentally, that New Labour certainly did used to do exactly that. They used to go on with photo fits of candidates, with showing them with a beard and without. And I think they probably found on the whole that the one without the beard was more popular, because it just seemed like, you know, a more normal kind of person, to use the Owen Smith phrase. But I think if you look at Corbyn, I mean, people have all kinds of views of him. We've always said I've said it to him before, he's trimmed his beard too much and he's not anywhere near the Nick Timothy full organic kind of look, unfortunately. But you hear all kinds of criticisms about why he can't be leader, why he can't be PM, but you find very little to say, well, he can't be because he's got a beard. I'm sure you can find a satirical website or two that will say, you know, he can't trust it because it's a beard. But it's not really the big focus now that perhaps it would have been even 10 years ago. So I think, again, things have moved on a bit. And even in the Conservative Party, that has tended to be, although of course it had the last bearded Prime Minister in North Salisbury going back well over a century now, you had Stephen Crabb, John Randall.
Very sticky end.
Yeah.
Completely proving my nan's
Well,
axiom.
John Randall, who's of course retired now, Boris Johnson has his seat, former joint winner of the Parliamentary Beard of the Year. So yeah, I think even there,
what do you look
changing.
For when you're judging the Parliamentary Beard of the Year?
Well, it's an online poll now.
Okay.
So we tend to... It's not really a style of beard. It's based on the impact that the person with the beard has had in the House of Commons. So it's... And hopefully a positive one. So it's that kind of... Now, obviously, one's views about what's positive and negative will vary. But it's the combination of being hirsute and promoting a positive image of the hirsute, because, you know, you're right. Going back, the link between somebody having a beard and somebody thinking about them positively, for example, in political terms, really didn't exist very much. So to try and say, well, actually, there are some MPs now who've got beards, and it adds gravitas to what they've got to say rather than makes them look a bit dodgy.
I'd say exactly the opposite. I think why we don't trust Jeremy Corbyn in terms of beards is because he can't even be bothered to run a razor blade across his face to sort of shape up and look sharp. So how can we expect him to run the country?
But I mean, probably you and I would both say it's sort of sexist to judge a woman by her hairdo. So is it not slightly sexist to judge a man?
I think the real... Terribly sexist. Okay, so there's a massive point about misogyny and sexism here, and it is about how men grow beards on their face while women have to have their bikini lines torn apart.
So you have to.
Well, they do, according to young millennial males who expect, you know, complete pre-adolescent contours. shall we say. And they're happy to grow these sort of very twisty, massive things on their face, but they find pubic hair really offensive. So I think that's the real issue of sexism. But yes, I suppose it is sexist to judge a man by his beard. I think one of the things, apparently the reason why they grow them is because men are scared of women. There's been research that sort of a beard shows that you can do something a woman can't do, and that beard booms occur when women's rights are very much in vogue. So the massive beard boom that took place from 1850 to 70 was when women argued for equality. And I've read this fascinating monograph by Lucinda Hawksley, and she says, "The thicker became the beards of British men, and the more intransigent their opposition became. Beards, whiskers and bristling moustaches were a viscerally visual representation of the idea that this was the one thing that women would never be able to do."
Keith, you've got more female leaders than ever. Do you think the rise in beards has got something to do with men trying to sort of exert their macho qualities?
Well, I would hope not. We really don't go into that place around the parliamentary beard or the Beard Liberation Front. It's kind of a big thing in the US, which is one of the reasons why we've... You know, we try and keep an eye, shall we say, on what goes on, because in the US, not to put too fine a point on it, there seems to be a connection between the length of some men's beards and the length of their sexual organs, which, frankly, you know, doesn't bear thinking about too much. Although
apparently a man's beard grows faster when he's not having sex.
It might say something about ZZ Top, but they're getting on a bit now, so who knows. They've been dyeing their beards as well.
Do you not find it extraordinary that young men are kind of basically aping militant jihad with their beard styles?
Well, I don't think they... yeah, I mean,
they look at the Taliban and they go, "I want a beard like that."
Yeah, I mean, we're not keen on the Taliban for obvious reasons. And I think, you know, if you look at the... not quite the same, but not unrelated, Osama bin Laden, who apparently is dead now. Of course, he never had a beard. He was a clean-shaven businessman, a very successful one, until he went into the jihad business, as it were. And then, of course, the beard comes because it's about promoting an image. You say, "Oh, this is deeply held religious conviction." Well, it's not. It's just the same as over here. He's growing the beard because he thinks it's going to say something about his views on life. Perhaps it did, I don't know. But
And Keith, just to finish off, do you think Nick Timothy could be a contender for Parliamentary Beard of the Year?
Well, he's not an MP, but he is a prominent political figure, and the beard is a particularly magnificent one. I think we might, you know, it's within our remit to tweak the rules slightly to include political advisers and
so on. Could you have him as May's beard? Because she doesn't have one herself, she could have a proxy to grow a beard for her.
There is that, I suppose. But I think he could enter on his own right, and I think he could well be a contender. But there will be a lot of contenders this year because there are just a lot more beards in Parliament than there were, say, 10 years ago.
And Emily, has Keith convinced you that not all men with beards are totally
after meeting
unworthy?
Keith, I fully trust him. So, yes,
that was Emily Hill and Keith Flatt. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? We've got a new trial offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.